Welcome, listener. This is Louis, host of The Cove, the podcast where we go deep with crypto builders along the path to 100 million daily signers. Today, we've got Sheck, founder of Gum, on the show. Gum is a collection of Legos for building social sticky apps that users love. 2023 is the year of finding product market fit and getting users, and Sheck and his team are laser focused on creating the primitives to enable teams to do just that. I found Sheck's vision for the future of social apps super compelling and well worth the listen. Before we dive in, I'd like to share a bit about Streamflow, who make this podcast possible. Streamflow is hassle-free on-chain token operations using money streams. Stop using an Excel sheet and start using Streamflow for automated token vesting and payroll. Streamflow is the market leader on Solana, twice audited with over 500 million in TVL, 37,000 plus streams created, and 40 plus clients, including outstanding teams like Raindrops, Hubble, Jungle DeFi, Heavenland, Genopets, and the list goes on. To set up hassle-free vesting contracts and automated payroll, head over to streamflow.finance and get started today. I'm here today with Sheck from Gum. Gum is aiming to empower developers with a host of tools to build out rich experiences that people stick to. Sheck, welcome to The Cove.
Happy to be here, Louis.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I recently saw Gum on Twitter, and immediately it stuck out to me that you guys have a strong focus on building sticky apps, which is something that I believe we desperately need in the crypto space and the Web3 space. And so I wanted to get you on and hear, yeah, your thoughts and your ideas around what you're building to sort of leverage or to unlock these sticky apps that we so desperately need. To kick things off, I'd love to hear a bit about your background, because you do have a bit of background on Solana actually prior to Gum. So could you just share with the listeners kind of how you come into crypto and particularly Solana?
Okay, yeah, sure. So before Solana, I was an early engineer at Semantics Team that built like large scale data pipelines, machine learning training infrastructure, even a full blown analytics project, right? So I spent a lot of time working with large scale distributed systems and just gigantic and systems that manage large amount of data. And so, as you can imagine, these are like very these are very complex engineering systems, right? And in 2020, my company got acquired, and then after the acquisition, it kind of opened up my mind space and time. It's like I went from a small startup to a very large org, so that meant that I'm naturally very bored and have a lot of time, right? So that's when I start seeing a lot of activity happening on crypto, a lot of activity that is happening on DeFi. So I set up like an on Twitter account. It was anon then, now not so anon anymore. But then, yeah, so that's how the whole thing started. And yeah, so then I started hanging out on Twitter. I saw that people were trying to build, or excited about this thing called Solana. So I started looking deep into it. And I really liked the engineering choices, that the approach to, designing this smart contract runtime, and the whole idea of, proof of history. All of that like really appealed to me, and I started going deeper and deeper into it, right? Before I knew it, I was like super deep into it, and I started writing deep dives about everything that I learned. And that was also my way of just giving back to the community and helping them get started building on Solana, because there was this mismatch between people coming from a different kind of background. For example, if you're coming from a Solidity background where the programming model is completely different to a Solana where the programming model is drastically different. So I would start creating this content which would help them understand the Solana model quite deeply, So when I was doing this, I realized that one, I was writing all this content about Solana. There was no Solana native place for me to publish this, right? So in the Ethereum world, you had Mirror, but then in the context of Solana, there was my options were only Medium, Substack. So I wanted to create something that would primarily just power my own blog. So I ended up creating Wordcell, right? And one thing led to another, and we ended up winning Riptide, and then, you know, went full time into Web3, and Wordcell went on mainnet, right? So while we were building Wordcell, one of the guiding principles for us was to build a product experience where we wanted to abstract the UX to a point where if you forget the fact that it's a connector wallet, it just appears like any other web app, because you do not want to surprise your users or just give them a drastically different experience, because it's like, well, it's Web3, so everything is different. So we wanted to consciously avoid that trap. So we took like painstaking effort and creating a good product design that would appeal to a wider set of audience. Like during the course of this, we realized that all the primitives that we have created can be useful to a broader set of consumer applications. Right, because most consumer applications today are built in such a way that you know, it's a wallet interacting with the protocol, and all the nitty-gritties of the protocol, you know, leaks into the application layer, so the abstraction is very leaky, right? So we wanted to focus on creating this, take all of our primitive, roll them up into these Legos that anyone can just directly plug into to make their user experience better. And that's how Gum came to be, right? So if you think about it, the blogging platform is probably one of the simplest kind of social media application. That is, we got LiveJournal and Blogspot before we got Facebook and MySpace, right? So that was the idea. So with Wordcell, we had created all this social primitives like profile, post, connection, you know, interest graph, social graph. So we had all of these primitives, and it made sense for us to put out those primitives as this individual social Legos that become inherently composable across any app that taps into it.
Right. So in a sense, Gum was formed out of what the Lego blocks that were built for Wordcell, and you realized that those Lego blocks could become, you know, basically generically used by other teams. And so then that spurred you guys on to build out Gum. Could you share like some of the main Lego blocks that constitute Gum?
Yeah, for sure. So there are like, one of the key things or the starting point into Gum is this idea of a user-based identity system, right? So today, when a wallet interacts with an application, the wallet as a primary identifier is kind of misleading, because it does not allow you to do key rotation efficiently. What happens when you want to move your account or your entire information from one wallet to another? That makes it super messy, right? So one of the first things that we introduced is this user-based identity system. So user is a core primitive. And then we also have another primitive called namespace, which is like, when we imagine different applications, you will have applications that cuts across many of these namespaces, right? Like a professional, personal, degen, gaming. So, and when you think about identity, like your identity is like, but you, exhibit a different type of identity in a different setting. So that's what namespaces encapsulate. So as a combination of user and namespaces, you can create profiles. So you will have one, a user will have one profile and professional namespace one and personal one in Degen and one in gaming. So think of these profiles as this composable blocks, which any application in the namespace can tap into. Imagine a gaming profile, which any game can use, and it has all the information about, it can pull in, it has all the games that you have played or all the points that you have collected, all the level information, and that being available on any other game that you log into with this profile, right? Same thing for your, and similarly in your professional namespace, imagine a Web3 LinkedIn, which has your profile and all your accomplishment. And then the same profile you use to log into some other professional application. And all the information about you is also accessible there. So it kind of creates this, it creates this foundation for interoperable and composable profiles. And on top of that, now you can start creating posts, you can start creating a social graph, and then you can also start creating an interest graph as, you know, as by virtue of other applications using them. So in order to summarize this,
And who's the, I was just going to ask, who is the owner of those social profiles? Does the user own them in their wallet, or is that maintained by Gum?
The user owns them. These are like individual, a profile is a PDA and it's owned by the user. So everything here, right from the user, is owned by the user themselves. So it's like a fully user-owned identity system.
Okay, so it's great. So I don't know if this is like a naive question, but, you know, is it almost as if the user has like an NFT for, you know, something similar to an NFT in their wallet that corresponds to like their professional profile, their... Because right now, if you think of a, you know, an average user, maybe they have like a PlayStation Network profile, they have a LinkedIn, they have an Instagram, they have a Google profile. So there you have, you know, like you have the gaming profile, you have the professional profile, you have the social profile, you have maybe like a, I don't know, a personal profile. Is that how people should think about it?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, you can think of this as a new asset that you own, like your profile itself as an asset, right? So the way in which we define NFT today is like very, very limiting, because an NFT today refers to one static image and everything is in that static image, or it points to a URL and whatever is in the URL, right? But then essentially what you're creating here is you're creating this on-chain mapping of different assets that you create, and that represented by one single identifier. So maybe it's the one, probably one way to visualize this is to think of it as a tree of NFTs, if you will.
A tree of NFTs?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And in terms of like, say I have a gaming profile and I'm playing like, you know, Aurori, DeFi Land, something else, and I'm owning, say, a bunch of different items. Is that like, where is the information stored? Or, you know, do I then own, I own the items, right? I own the NFTs. And is that sort of also maintained in my profile somehow?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. So once you have this interoperable standard where it may not necessarily just be items, it could something be as simple. For example, on iOS, you have this activity center or game center, right, where different iOS games can post scores under your, Apple Arcade profile or game center profile. It's a very similar idea. So that you can imagine, imagine a game which wants to implement the social leaderboard, or somebody wants to build an on-chain version of, what is that very popular game, Words with Friends. Yeah, so it's a casual game like Words with Friends, mm-hmm. where you want to play this game with your friends, and then there is a shared leaderboard, right? So basically what this these profiles create is like a common standard for sharing data between applications in a way that you personally own, I mean, you, the user owns them.
Yeah, maybe like one example I'm just thinking for people would be if you've ever used Steam, you know, Steam, before Steam, every game would have its own chat interface and, you know, its own way of communicating with people, its own servers. And then at some point, Steam came along and made like a meta app where you can own all your games, and then you can add friends that like they go across all the games. Now, of course, you have different competitors to Steam now as well. So there's a higher level. And I guess that's kind of how you would describe this game profile. It's the higher level even above something like Steam, where it's available for any game, all items, you know, communication. It can essentially be sort of the top level way that it connects all your different gaming experiences, which is super cool. You want to tell us a bit about session keys, because I think that's also a key piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if you look at how one of the major blockers to most on-chain very high-touch apps, right? For example, social apps, games, and anything else that is very, very, very high-touch and high interaction-heavy, is one of the major blockers for them is that maybe every time you want to do something on the blockchain, you want to call a smart contract or whatever, you need to sign a transaction, right? And every and imagine in a place where things are moving so in an interface where things are moving so quickly, and you want to add this friction of a signature or a transaction that makes it like 10 times worse than what is on Web2, right? So it's also a significant pain point for any of this application. So in order to bring it to a point where it's on par with Web2, so that we can sell on the other benefits, session keys are super important. So what session keys enables is a way to basically create like secondary signers to your, it allows you to create secondary signers so that you know, for every time you start a gaming session or every time you start like a session on your social app, a new key gets created, and that key has a validity of like a certain period of time, right? And within that period of time, only specific set of instructions can accept the signatures from these keys. So it makes for an experience where you can have a very, very smooth user experience where you're not have to, where your usage is not interrupted by a pop-up asking you to sign a transaction. And that gets replaced with just one transaction when you start the session.
So just if we talk practically, does that look a bit like I'm hopping on Twitter and then I'm like liking a bunch of tweets and I'm retweeting? Instead of having to always confirm and sign every action, I do like a one signature at the beginning of the session, and then all the following on actions are essentially like contained inside that session key, or they're sort of authorized by that session key.
Yeah, precisely. To give you a Web2 analogy, it's like, for example, the current version of how Web3 is like you log into Twitter, and when you log into Twitter, you have your username and password. Imagine if you had to enter your username and password for every time you post a tweet, or every time you retweet,
mm-hmm. yeah.
or every time you like something. These are things that the interface is designed in such a way that you do that at a very, very high velocity, right? You do that so often. So if you had to enter your password every single time you do it, that's like, it's like it's such a major pain that
friction.
Yeah, it introduces a tremendous amount of friction, right? So that's why the Web2 world invented sessions. So now with this session token, you can send your session token to your backend server, and then the backend server authenticates that this is the user, right? So that's essentially how session keys came about in Web2. So in the Web3 counterpart is very, very similar, where instead of you signing every single transaction with your original key, you authorize a secondary signer, which is only valid for a particular set of time and has access to a particular set of instructions for a particular period of time. So that means that your session key cannot withdraw or detect funds from your account, or it cannot. And maybe this level of security is what you would need for a DeFi application or when you are involved in moving funds, right? But then for a game where you are so immersed in the gameplay, you do not want every single one of these moves to, you know, come in and disrupt your flow and make it like, yeah. So that's essentially the idea. It drastically changes the type of applications and the type of user experiences that you can build today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's for those like low value, regular, high input tasks, right? That are regular. Like if you imagine playing a game, an RPG, say you're playing like, what's it called? Skyrim. And you play for 100 hours, and every time you open a chest and get an item, you have to sign a transaction. That's impossible. Like no one would play that. Even if it was, you know, even if you can make $500 just for playing it, people still wouldn't play it. So it, yeah, completely can understand the use case there. I guess the challenge will just be finding the right time to use session keys versus actually having the user sign. Like what is an acceptable amount of, an acceptable amount of security for the level of transaction?
Yeah. So one good thing is that when people integrate with our session keys, the smart contract, which integrates with our session key protocol or session key contract, can specify which instructions can accept the session key, right? So that way it's fully scoped. So for example, when we integrated the session key as a concept into the core GUM program, one of the things that we did was making updates to profile is something that happens very rarely. And also it's something that's potentially destructive to the user. So maybe that should only be done by that should have like a high amount of security, right? So it should only be done by your primary key. But whereas you liking a post, it's not as destructive, right? So you can delegate that to a secondary signer. So it allows, one of the good things about session keys is that it allows you to scope it to an instruction or a set of instruction. Before session keys, the only options were to create embedded wallets, right? But then embedded wallets have embedded or in-app wallets create this situation where it fractures your identity. It's no longer interoperable. You cannot take that wallet from one application to another. Not only that, now you have to rely on the application to actually make it secure, you know, to make sure that the app has followed all the standard security practices to make sure your in-app wallet is secure. And also even with all of that, it creates a scenario where you have like a one-size-fits-all security policy for everything, right? So creating this kind of this tiered signer system creates a world where you can have the ones that need the utmost security can be secured by your hardware wallet or whatever is on, or your Saga phone seed vault, right? And then there are other things which, you know, which are much more high action, which can just be enabled via the session key.
Yeah, it sounds really, really exciting. I'm very keen to see what people build with this in the upcoming months. I'd like to move a bit further and discuss around Solana, like what was attractive to build GUM on Solana in particular. Could you share, like, was there a decision at some point you mentioned at the beginning that Solana was attractive to you because of the engineering trade-offs that they made. Yeah, could you speak a little bit about the status quo right now? Like what keeps you on Solana, and what's made it attractive to build GAM on Solana?
Yeah, for sure. So one, Solana has like extremely low fees to a point where you can actually subsidize, to a point where, for example, applications building on top of GAM can subsidize the gas costs. And this gas costs are deterministic, right? There's like, no matter what you do, it's the same amount of gas. The only problem, so for pre-compression, there would be variable costs involved because of rent. Every account that you create needs a deposit called the rent. So with compression, what it essentially creates is a world where you prepay the rent, and it drastically brings down the cost. So now the next time anyone interacts with your protocol or creates a post or follows someone or reacts to a post or whatever, all of this do not create new accounts. They just get compressed and rolled up into one single Merkle tree. So there the cost is just for one single transaction. So essentially it's a lot of this forward thinking architectures, things that make it super attractive to build consumer apps. Essentially, if you think about it from the perspective of, can an application developer or who is building this app subsidize it for their users? I think you can only do that on Solana without compromising on, you get the security of L1 instead of security of like a sidechain or an L2. You get the security of an L1 in a place where the transaction cost can be subsidized directly by the applications. That's very, very powerful for onboarding like a massive massive wave of consumers. And Solana also has like a very, very forward thinking approach to consumer adoption. For example, Solana Mobile is like, it recognizes that the next wave of users are going to be like consumer heavy. We actually need to build like fun, usable experiences. I also need to make self-custody easy. So it captures all the good things about what it actually means to, it captures all the values of crypto and packages into a format that is usable to everyday user.
Yeah, I think you put that really well. Just one point for the perhaps less technically minded, could you just unpack in a bit more detail the account compression that you were mentioning?
Yeah. Think of it this way. An average user on social media probably creates like 10 gigabytes of data, right? So if you were to put all of that on a blockchain so that you can assert full ownership over the data that you create, it's going to be incredibly expensive. So what account compression creates is a world where you could compress all of this data using something called should I use words like hashing and Merkle tree, or
maybe we can, yeah, like it's good to be accurate, but maybe we can give some kind of I know there's always a fine line between being accurate but also making it understandable, so you can use the technical terms, but maybe we can also just explain a little bit roughly what that means.
Yeah, sure. I'll first give like an explain like I'm five type of an explanation, and then we could probably go a little bit deep. So the whole idea is that a typical social media user generates like several gigabytes of data per year, and putting all of this on a blockchain can be very expensive because you typically pay per byte of data that you consume, or the byte of data that you require to be held in a blockchain. And for several gigabytes of data, it's going to be very, very expensive. But then putting your personal, having a way to assert ownership of your personal data on a blockchain is very valuable. So what compression creates is a world where you can tightly pack all the data about you into such a small format where, it's very, very tiny. And now that it is very tiny, you can pay very, very little fee, almost as much as you would spend on a couple of packs of gum, right? So you can store all of your social data on the blockchain for the price of a couple of packs of gum instead of spending several hundreds of thousands of dollars just for one user. And this is only possible on Solana.
And this is mostly a useful unlock for projects, right? Because then they can subsidize the cost of their users.
Exactly.
Okay, got you.
Exactly. Now you've brought it to a point where, it's like the price of the pack of a gum. Now, what that means is that now it becomes a line item in your user acquisition cost, right? So you can factor that in as you go and acquire more users. And then you also have like a deterministic way to convert whatever you spent to acquire that user back into revenue. The underlying thing is that we are competing with like anything consumer competes with the equivalent in a centralized world where they don't have to pay anything. It's unimaginable to expect, users of Instagram to pay per API call that they make, or in whatever the server builds on AWS or GCP is going to be. All of that is abstracted, right? So you have this very, very neat set of abstractions that make it like that just does not get in the way of the user. So today the abstractions are so leaky that every step of the way they leak and get in the way of the user. And when you want to take this to a billion users who are arguably very, very less tech savvy, and then they just do not want to be bothered with these level of details, right? All they care about is, okay, what can I do and how quickly can I accomplish it? Because they have so many other things that they want to worry about or that they want to focus on, as opposed to figuring out every finer details of what this app does. I mean, my mom can use Instagram and WhatsApp so easily, right? The same is true for probably most Web2 products. Now, what is the equivalent of that in Web3? Right. So if you're speaking about taking crypto to a billion users, it actually has to be in a place where you have all of these set of building blocks or Lego blocks that makes your application usable before it can even become sticky.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a great point there. There's so much talk about we're so early, this is the future of France, etc. The first billion users, all these kind of catchphrases, but you don't hear a lot of concrete steps towards actually getting to that future. And I mean, of course, everyone imagines that they are bringing us towards that future, with every different independent protocol or dApp that they're building. But I can see with what you guys are working on at GUM that you're really very practically looking at building important pieces of the puzzle to actually build user-facing sticky apps. So this is really exciting stuff, I think. I'd like to just get your thesis, and I think you've kind of hit on it here, but maybe you can just unpack it a bit more. Like, up until this point, social applications have really not taken hold in crypto. I would say that apart from a few apps like Stepin, there hasn't been any big like commercial customer-facing successes. Maybe Axie Infinity is another one. These games, In general, it's more the degens. It's like the anonymous people on Twitter. It's the, you know, DeFi hacks. And like, this is the kind of, I would say, like one of the most exciting kind of lifeblood parts of crypto. How do we get to a point where social is another like lifeblood of crypto?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. Today, honestly, I mean, if you were to ask and approach those questions, honestly, we just do not have the basic infrastructure necessary to build social applications that would compete with the behemoths. Almost every lens, forecaster, everybody else who is creating this ecosystem, everybody approaches it from a perspective where, okay, let's create a Web3 equivalent of an existing Web2 social network. But then one thing that they fail to recognize is that, like, they are going up against the headwind because, like, Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, these behemoths have like 3 billion plus users, and that's like incredibly strong network effects, right? In order to break them away from that, it's from a place like, it's like, for example, it's like you have like a large amount of users who are addicted to sugar, and now you want to sell them like this kale juice, right? Selling them on kale juice is just not going to happen. So you have to take like a drastically different approach. There you're fighting against the headwind. So the approach that we are taking is that we recognize the importance of a composable open social graph and open identity primitives, right? So however, if you were to focus on building a Web2, you know, a competing, rather a clone of an existing Web2 product, that's probably not the most interesting way to go about it, because those are behemoths and they have like gigantic network effects. Rather, it is much more fruitful to focus on what we can uniquely do because of crypto and the user-owned identity and user-owned social data creates a world where the user can share with applications what data they want about themselves. So it creates this world where the user themselves are their own API. So now imagine every application that users Gum profile can request the users for the data that they want to share, right? And then you can also have this data can be useful to applications to figure out what exactly is a persona of their user, what are all the other data that they have that they can share with you. It allows you to build like a much more, it allows the applications to improve their own product, their own understanding of who their users are. So it creates this world where you have much more finer visibility into who your users are as opposed to what is possible in Web2, right? And then it also creates like a much more direct relationship with your users. That is like super, super important to everything that we are building with Web3. So our question is that, like, don't go after the headwind, but follow the tailwind. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. I like
the feel free to.
Yeah, it does. And the thing that I'm taking away from what you're saying is, you have a real, from what I'm getting, there's a real focus on basically allowing teams to harness the tools you're building on their journey towards finding product market fit with their users. And this is, for me, kind of the theme of 2023. If we need to find product market fit urgently across many different areas, if we can't find product market fit, there will arrive a time where people ask, you know, what is it actually good for? And so, you know, at some point, it's now been 14 years. I'm not keeping track, but it's been many years since Bitcoin was first invented. It's been maybe 7-8 years or something since Ethereum came out. And so, you know, the it's pedal to the metal time to build applications that find product market fit with actual consumers. And I'm really excited to see what people can do with Gum and what you guys are able to unlock with this new primitive. So, Sheck, where can people learn more about Gum if they want to check out the docs or they want to get involved with you guys on Twitter?
Yeah, so you can check out the docs on docs.gum.fun, and our programs and our SDK, all of that is like fully open source. You can start, there is like a quick start section on the docs for anyone who wants to get started with making their application sticky.
Nice. And on Twitter?
Yeah, we are Gum is Fun. Fun with two N's.
Gum is Fun. Okay, perfect. Then thanks so much, Sheck, for coming on and telling us all about Gum. I'm personally very excited to see hopefully some new projects coming out that are going to be using it in the coming months.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm personally super excited about Session Keys. I think they are like a massive and lock in terms of type of UX people can build.
Yeah, 100% agree. This is going to be an exciting few months to see what sort of in it, because sometimes when you design a new primitive like that, it's hard to see exactly how people will use it, and then you put it out to the world, and then you know you'll find the strangest, interesting, compelling use cases as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Alrighty, thanks, Sheck. Talk soon.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
All right. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you liked it, make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app. Leave us a review if you're feeling generous. And I'd also like to give a brief reminder that nothing said on the podcast is financial advice. My views are my own. And when navigating crypto, remember that you are responsible for your own assets and always do your own research.